This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, a car crash 30 years ago has Republican Tom Foley back in the news. Secretary of State Denise Merrill is in the news because of an email list that sounds surprisingly like something the last Secretary of State was doing. And are you shocked to hear that Hartford is back in the news for shady fiscal dealings? We'll tackle all of those stories this week in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us as always, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can also go online to WNPR.org. There you can seek out The Wheelhouse Digest, which is our daily digest of some of the news stories we're following throughout the week. Again, that's WNPR.org, our brand new website. Joining me in studio today are a few people who are going to talk about the big news of the day right now, what's happening with the government shutdown and the potential fiscal crisis that looms by midnight tonight. Colin McEnroe, of course, the host of WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show and now the star of a brand new fundraising mug. Colin, welcome.
I'm very excited about that. I'm also going to be on the dangerous catch if the crab fleet can never get out of the harbor, which is another thing that's stuck because of the shutdown.
I will watch that.
Yeah, I'm actually on the deadliest catch, landlocked edition.
Landlocked edition. Colin McEnroe is here. Ronald Shuren is here. He's an associate professor in residence at UConn's Department of Political Science. Ron, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And also, I want to welcome him, business reporter for WNPR, Sujata Srinivasan. Who joins us as well. Sujata, good to see you as always.
Likewise, John. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what we're going to do is we're going to talk in a moment about some of the impact that this ongoing government shutdown is having here in Connecticut on business and elsewhere. But first, as we heard all throughout Morning Edition, it seemed as though there was potentially going to be a deal to solve this fiscal crisis. But again, it has been, averted. The Senate says that maybe they're still hopeful in talks. We're not going to replay everything that Ron Elving and Steve Inskeep were talking about this morning on Morning Edition. But essentially, Ron, why don't you give me your big take on this? Why are we stuck in this mess a couple weeks out? The government's still shut down, and it seems as though we're about to hurtle over a cliff where the U.S. won't be able to pay its debts.
We have a perfect storm. We have a situation in which the parties have moved to the polls. We have a weak leadership in the House of Representatives. We have a president who is, for all his other gifts, not particularly adept at dealing with Congress. We have a very large federal debt, and we have obligations that we seem to be unable to meet. There was an effort in 2011, as I'm sure you know, to structure a plan for dealing with the deficit in an ongoing way. That fell apart. The result was the sequester. Then we had the government shutdown, and now within 24 hours, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, we'll have the government unable to borrow any more money, or so it is said. And all of that creates a sense of crisis. We're hurtling from, it seems, one crisis to another.
You know, this idea of the large federal debt, which is part, of course, of the conversations that are happening in Washington right now. There is a group in Washington that wants us to attack that debt and figure out ways to cut the budget. I know that household analogies are never exactly right here. But in most people's lives, the way to deal with a large amount of debt is not to say, I'm not going to pay it. And that's what it seems like the United States government is threatening to do right now. And that is shaking up the markets. And it's also showing some threats that the United States might actually be downgraded in its rating. We might have a hard time borrowing money when we need to.
That's right. And if we do borrow money, we'll have to pay a higher interest rate, and that'll trickle down to all consumers. So it's a major problem. Yes, indeed, households have to pay their debt. If they don't pay their debt, they find their houses foreclosed and they find themselves out in the street. That's not the way for a major Western government to operate.
Colin, so as you are watching this, I mean, we've been talking about this over the course of the last couple of weeks. It's easy to say that there's one side in Washington that's holding everything up. I suppose if you were sitting on the other side, you'd say the other side is holding it up. What do you think we're looking at here right now?
Yeah, I guess I would respectfully disagree with Ron a little bit. I don't think this is a problem that has I don't agree with that. I actually do think this is a problem created by one side. I also don't think that the parties have gone to opposite polls. I think the Democratic Party is perched closer to the center than I've ever seen it in my lifetime. And I don't think you really can say, well, they're both causing this problem right now. I think the Republicans are causing this problem right now. I think somewhere between 30 and 100 Republicans are causing this problem right now. It's not as though each side has an equally legitimate argument. One side is trying to make the government function the way it's supposed to. The other is trying to effectively to rewrite the rules of government and doing it with a gun in their hands. I think this is a perfect storm only in the sense that John Boehner cannot do this very simple thing. Get control of the House away from a relatively small group of his own party members.
Well, one of the things that I think is important is when you say a government working the way it's supposed to, an important piece in that is government working the way that the Congress has already set up government to work. Mm-hmm. It may be that you, whoever you are, disagrees with that, but essentially government has been set up to work this way because the people's representatives have done this over the course of time. This is what we're dealing with.
Yeah, and what's being substituted is the politics of crisis. And what the problem that we have now, too, is even if granting a resolution of this in the next 24 hours or so, it's clear now. You could even hear it in Saxby Chambliss, who was interviewed on Morning Edition this morning, talking about how Ted Cruz, you know, initially wanted to do this in order to defund Obamacare. Saxby Chambliss thinks that Ted Cruz gets now that that's not a realizable goal. This time around, he said. So right now, Ted Cruz is looking around for something else he can get, like a petulant child who staged a tantrum to get an ice cream soda, found out he can't have it, and now is trying to figure out if there's a toy that he can get. And if you listen closely to what Chambliss said, he said, but maybe in the next cycle. So in other words, we're just going to go through this over and over again unless the Republicans are so completely humiliated by this experience that they understand not to do it in the future.
Well, I think Colin is right that indeed the Republicans are overwhelmingly to blame for the current crisis. The blame that I would ascribe to the Obama administration comes at an earlier stage. The president is a great communicator, or at least that's been what people have said about him. And of course, he won two elections, coming in the first one from obscurity. He warned the country that the sequester would be a disaster. People look around and say, "What? What disaster? I don't see any big problem." That threatens the president's credibility on this particular situation. So people who are not economists, not particularly aware of how the business cycle is affected, say, "I don't believe that this is a big crisis." Secondly, I think you're absolutely right that a small group of Republicans are holding John Boehner hostage and holding the country hostage. John Boehner originally subscribed to something called the Hastert Rule. I don't know if you've ever discussed that before on the show, that he wouldn't bring things to the floor of the House unless a majority of the Republicans supported them. Clearly, if he brought something to the floor of the House, it would pass because almost all Democrats and 30, 40, 50 Republicans would support it. He has not done that. So, yes, indeed, the Democratic system isn't functioning. And just one more point. In the last election, the Republicans got 2 million fewer votes in House of Representatives elections in aggregate than did the Democrats. But the Republicans control the House because of the way the districting has worked. So if you even look at the Democratic system, small d, you see that it's not really working because you have a minority of a minority controlling things. So, yes, indeed, in the immediate sense, the Republicans are to blame. But in the broader sense, the president of the United States has to take a more aggressive, assertive and adept leadership role.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I mean, certainly President Obama sowed the seeds of some of the problems he has right now by drawing a series of red lines, allowing them to cross it and doing nothing about it. It's as though he is finally right now in a very dire situation, trying to become the president many of us always wanted him to be. You know, this is the first time he seems to have gathered all of his aides together. He apparently told them, even in their body language, he wants them to make it clear to Republicans that they're not moving, they're not doing this, because we can't function this way. I mean, it's not only a danger to ourselves, but a danger to the world, just in the same sense that the problems of Greece and Spain and places like that have infected the entire EU. We can sneeze and give the flu to other countries right now.
If Greece can cause a global problem, the United States certainly can cause a global problem with the way it acts in Washington. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're in the Wheelhouse with Ron Sherman and Colin McEnroe, who you just heard. In just a moment, we're going to be talking about some of the business impacts on this. Aaron's calling from Hartford. Hey, Aaron, go ahead.
Good morning. I'm an attorney in Hartford, and I practice immigration law. I wanted to share how the shutdown has directly affected many non-U.S. citizens here in Connecticut. As of October 1st, the immigration court in Hartford has been completely closed. So doors shut, lights off. And what that means is that individuals such as my clients who have been waiting up to 2 years to have relief from removal or deportation have to wait even longer. It also means that and all of the process regarding immigration for removal and deportation has stopped completely.
My goodness, Aaron. So, Ron, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, this is a major life crisis for a lot of innocent people. Let me just mention a much more trivial. One of my students was telling me that in another class, he was working on a paper. He needed some Census Bureau data, couldn't get it. Again, not a very serious problem, but it's just an indication that this is not how a major government should operate.
And I've met a number of people who are actually furloughed from work, people who are not getting paid right now or working and not getting paid. Aaron, thank you very much for sharing that story. I want to actually go to a story that we covered this week. Democratic State Rep. Andy Fleischman is chair of the Education Committee. He talked to our Diane Orson about the difficulty of finishing Connecticut's grant application for the next Race to the Top competition.
It's a pretty sad state of affairs for the U.S. Department of Education and a lot of other federal departments. The lights are on, but nobody's home. And, you know, that sounds kind of funny unless you're busy preparing a 300-page application and you have questions and there is no one who can provide an answer.
And so just like the story Aaron just told, that's essentially the state of Connecticut trying to figure out information so that they can apply for a Race to the Top grant, something the federal government has said you should apply for in order to get federal education money. Now we're stymied there. I want to bring in Sujata to talk a little bit about, though, how it's affecting some businesses. You've been writing about this, Sujata. It's big for a lot of Connecticut businesses, isn't it?
John, there is, to varying degrees, an impact on the operational side. The federal shutdown has affected businesses, but to put it in perspective, they're coasting along and they've been quite resilient. But the question everybody is asking me is how long? So the biggest issue facing businesses today, and that's what I'm hearing from scores of especially small business owners, is the uncertainty.
Mm.
How long is the shutdown going to last? What is going to happen to the debt ceiling? And it's that uncertainty that's causing them the biggest concern.
So, I know you've talked to a number of different companies, all across Connecticut. What are some of the stories that you're hearing?
Well, I was just talking to a Giovanni Tomasi, a CEO of a small company. They have about 12 employees in East Hartford called RSL Fiber Systems, and they make advanced lighting. Now, they have a new product out, and this is important for small businesses. I mean, the economy is just starting to take off. We're not having a spectacular recovery. So this company has developed and put out a new product, which it is unable to launch because it's stuck for a certification by federal inspectors. That department is closed. The Mine Safety and Health Administration is closed. And they're not able to get the product out, even though they have orders from 500 customers. So that's one level of impact.
And you've got other impacts. You talked actually to Menon Cox, CEO of Protein Sciences in Meriden. Let's listen here first.
What is certainly a concern of mine is we have this government contract that was awarded in 2009, but if the government reaches its debt ceiling and is not going to increase that, then we probably won't get paid, even though we have made all kind of obligations under that contract. So that could really impact our solvency down the road.
And again, that's Menon Cox, and Menon is from Protein Sciences,
CEO of Protein Sciences, and they've just launched the world's first eggless vaccine out of Meriden. And that company is, and this is approved for the 18 to 49 age group, as I reported, but they're unable to file for new application with the FDA to approve the vaccine for 50 plus.
And when you're talking about eggless vaccines, we've talked about this in the program before. Again, a couple years ago, there was this big flu outbreak, and we were running short on flu vaccines. And this company was looking years ago now for FDA approval for their product so that they could provide something that would be turned around much more quickly. If we have a flu outbreak this winter, they want to be able to provide their services to the American public, and you're saying they're being slowed down.
Well, the first batch of the egg-free vaccine for the 18 to 49 age group is on track to be shipped out. Those FDA inspectors are on site, and they are inspecting the batches. But the problem now is for the next set of approval, which could delay the next product launch for this additional age group. They are not able to apply for NIH grants, which is important to them, to start work on many of the research aspects, because you know those grant applications, that window is closed. It's also you spoke about the problem in getting federal data. And for Manon, the problem is not lack of access to CDC data, because it's a company that needs to track the flu outbreak. So it's something as small as I wouldn't say small, but relatively manageable impact, such as not being able to track data, to delays in approval, to the uncertainty over the debt crisis, and lack of SBA loans for small companies. RSL, for instance, wanted to extend its line of credit by $250,000. They need the cash. But they're not able to go through the bank because they're waiting for the SBA to reopen the doors.
And we're getting some phone calls, 288-602-757-266. Ned's calling from West Hartford. Hi, Ned. Go ahead.
Well, my observation through this entire year, my business is off 25%. I'm a renovation contractor, is that the only trickle-down from Washington is indecision. Right now we have no work, and we haven't had any work or potential of work for the last 2.5 weeks. Now, this is one thing that our barons and baronesses don't even have a clue about. I'm not a government contractor. I'm a private contractor, and it's affecting my business horrendously.
Ned, thank you very much for sharing your story, and I'm very sorry to hear that. And Colin, this is something, Sujata and Harriet Jones cover business for us all the time, and here's what we hear over and over again from businesses in Connecticut when it comes to government regulations, let alone government shutdowns. They say, look, all we really want is some certainty. It doesn't really matter what the regulations are. It doesn't matter so much about the taxes. What matters is that we know from year to year what's happening. And this sounds like the ultimate uncertainty. We don't even know what's going to happen with the government. We don't know when the government's going to open back up. And we don't know if the government does start back up, when it's going to shut down. Again, another couple months?
Yeah, I mean, I probably have less expertise about all this than anybody else in the room. But, I mean, the little bit of business that I've covered over my career, it is true that, I mean, businessmen seem not to mind if the sun rises in the west some morning. They just want to know that that's going to happen. I do think, though, now we've got sort of two different things in play. One of them is the effect of the government shutdown, which has been so effectively sketched out right here on this show in the last few minutes. The effect on financial markets is a whole separate thing. If we head towards default, I mean, first of all, even if we avert the kind of crisis that we've been talking about, even if there's some kind of accord in the next 24 hours, because of the amount of uncertainty about the future, bond markets are going to be examining the future deadlines. They're going to want to know, is it March 15th? Is it January 15th? When is the next one of these showdowns going to happen? Because that's the next window of uncertainty about the ability of the government to make good on its borrowing. And so these short-term interest rates, which are a key component of not only the American economy but the world economy, become these very uncertain instruments. And it really is. It's a remarkably dangerous situation. And it will have – I mean, I don't know what's causing Ned's problem right now, mm-hmm. but it will cause problems like Ned's problems in ways that are pretty difficult to trace but are clearly true.
I think that's absolutely right. I'm not an economist, but one of the things that I understand to be the case is in 2011, when we had a similar situation, the rest of the world was in a great period of turbulence, particularly Europe, and money had no place else to go. So people kept buying our bonds. Now things have stabilized a bit around the world, and maybe people will look to other places to invest their dollars, particularly the Chinese, and that will cause our interest rates to rise, and of course that will impact on consumers and all others.
You said you're not an economist. Let's hear from an economist. Peter Joy is with the Connecticut Business and Industry Association. He talked to Sujata a little bit earlier. He says the economy was growing reasonably well in Connecticut before the shutdown.
They've already done something that from economic terms is not positive, and if they continue down that path over the next couple of weeks, then it's really going to have a negative impact. I think eventually we're going to get back on that track to growth, but whether we get back on that track to growth in November or we get back to that track to growth in March or April, there's a big difference for a lot of people.
And Sujata, this is something that I know that you guys have been following closely. Connecticut specifically is in this very tenuous period of regrowth after the economic recession, and we are so reliant on the financial services industry, we are so reliant on defense contractors. What Peter Gioia and others are saying is all this uncertainty is going to just cause us to slow down even that much more.
Absolutely. Peter at CBIA, Alyssa De Jong at CERC, Stephen Lanza at UConn, they all speak with one voice that this is a we are seeing a recovery, but it's a relatively fragile recovery. Connecticut, after the 2008 recession, has, you know, lost, we've not regained, you know, we've just about regained half the jobs that we lost in after the 2008 recession. So we just have about, so far, about 60,000 jobs. So we still have a long way to go. On their part, Connecticut companies have been extremely resilient. They've, you know, more companies are exporting, according to the latest CBIA research. We are seeing diversification in markets. We are seeing international growth. So these companies are operating on a daily basis with a lot of uncertain variables, with global markets changing. But the government used to be the one certain variable. I mean, that was a constant. When everything else was changing, the risks, financial markets, products, risk, and so forth, the government was the one certainty. And the effect of that, the ripple effect of that is widening. So the businesses are impacted at varying levels, from the loan side as well as the regulatory side. And some of the mortgage loan officers that I've been talking to said because of the IRS shutdown, some mortgage closings are delayed because the tax transcripts haven't been returned to the banks. So we see that impact as well.
And that's just what we need in a housing recovery is for our housing starts to slow down, the fact that people can't get mortgages done as quickly. We've got to take a break. I want to thank Sujata Srinivasan, who's a business reporter, who's covering all this stuff, the impact of the government shutdown on Connecticut for WNPR. Thank you so much, Sujata. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, there's other news of this week. We'll also take your phone calls about the ongoing crisis in Washington. Kat tweets at us, the sequester's already been a disaster in the sciences, already a tight finding cuts, innovations in critical research are stifled. That's something that Kat has on her mind. You can join us right now with a tweet at Where We Live. But let's get to some other news as well. Tom Foley, Denise Merrill back in the news. And you want to buy a tennis tournament? Colin McEnroe's got a great deal for you. It's coming up next on The Wheelhouse. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable on Wednesdays. Colin McEnroe joins us. He's the host of WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show. What's in your show this afternoon, Colin?
We are talking about, I think appropriately, given some of the things we've been talking about today, we're going to be talking about the Scottish play, Macbeth, and actually specifically what it does, what lessons it does offer about naked ambition and willingness to put everything at risk for a greater gain.
I think you planned this out very, very nicely.
That's right.
That's coming up this afternoon.
Shakespeare's shutdown play.
At 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. Ronald Churin is here. He's associate professor in residence at UConn's Department of Political Science. In just a moment, we'll be bringing in R.L. Levin Becker from the Connecticut Mirror to talk about how Obamacare is going here in Connecticut a couple weeks into this launch. But first, let's get to some of the other news of the week. We get news yesterday from John Lender, who's had a very, very busy week at the Hartford Current. It's probably why he couldn't join us here today. Revelations about Tom Foley and some arrest records from long ago in his past. These are things, Colin, that we have known about, things that we talked about during the 2010 run for governor. As a matter of fact, here's Tom Foley just recently addressing some of these allegations on my show, Where We Live. He was talking about some of the allegations that he's made against Governor Daniel Malloy, against his administration, about whether or not they should be more truthful or forthcoming with some things. The Democrats then said, well, Tom, we'd like a little bit more information about your past arrest record. So here's a bit of our conversation.
Or whoever in the Democratic Party has asked for more transparency from you.
And we
can you
got
provide
it.
Can you provide more transparency about your arrest records in the past?
No,
than
there
has
are no
previously,
records.
Can there you
no,
provide more information about? Can,
there's no unreleased, undiscussed records there. So why do they keep going back to that? And this is something from 30 years ago. Do the citizens of Connecticut really care about something that happened 30 years ago? I don't think so. Let's talk. This is Politics 101.
Okay. So this is Politics 101. I'm not sure how he's doing in the class so far, Colin. So, I mean, this is new. This is something that we, I guess, hadn't heard.
Yeah, now we're hearing basically that whatever beef he had, he and this other driver apparently left a party at the same time. The chase that ensued took place over the course of about a mile. And apparently, according to lenders reporting, Foley's car struck the other car a total of five times. I guess in some cases it was after the car stopped moving. But at one of the collisions happened at a speed of 50 miles per hour. If it were a Plymouth Fury, I think he could invoke the Christine defense. It might be too late, but he could claim that it was supernaturally possessed car that was, you know, he didn't have any control over. You know, in some ways, look, this is a very old story. It's 1981.
It is.
So it's a very old story. It, you know, by all rights, probably shouldn't be a huge factor in a gubernatorial campaign, and it probably won't be. My prediction is it probably won't be. I think the analogy that I think of is John Rowland's famous suppressed 911 report. He and his then wife Debbie had some kind of domestic problem. It was a bad enough problem that the police were called. It was a bad enough problem that every possible legal instrument that was available was used to keep people like John Lender from looking at it. But everybody understood it was some kind of loss of control had gone on there. And Rowland was never made to pay a political price for that. My guess is that this isn't going to matter that much, but it doesn't help Tom Foley. He's trying to position himself right now as the reasonable guy, you know, the guy who can maybe kind of clean up government and bring a new, more common sense approach to government issue in a new period of higher ethical standards. None of this story isn't really consistent with that, but how much a 1981 beef is going to hurt him, I don't know.
Ron?
There's a whole varying pattern of how much past problems come to affect people, and you can look at, my goodness, you can look at Ted Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, about to win probably by double digits, had some driving problems before his first race. That was raised by his opponent. And when he won, he said, well, at least now I'll have a chauffeur. So, you know, people can get past some of those things. You look at people in Congress, David Vitter, Charlie Rangel, others, they've overcome it. Some have not. Foley has stumbled early on in so many significant ways that, you know, on the one hand, maybe you wonder about whether he's getting good advice. On the other, maybe he's getting all of this out there early enough, and then he can move on to other issues.
But this idea of getting it all out there, essentially what he says when asked several weeks ago is, it's all out there, there's nothing else to know. If indeed we're talking about Politics 101, you probably teach a class similar to Politics 101.
Yeah.
I mean, is that really how you do things? If you want to end the story, you put everything out there and say, this is what happened. This is what somebody's going to say happened. I have this version of the story, and now the story is over. But as these things leak out in little tiny dribs and drabs, doesn't it make it worse?
The trickle is it will kill you. And maybe Foley actually believed that there were no records. You know, who knows? But yes, you get it all out there right at the start, and then you hopefully can move on. It hurt Linda McMahon last time around when the bankruptcy issues came out later in the campaign. Hurt Chris Murphy, although obviously he overcame it when some of his financial problems kind of trickled out. We'll see.
I want to get to another story that happened this week, another story that John Lender's been working on, and this involves Denise Merrill, the Secretary of the State. You know, Colin, a couple of years ago when Susan Bisewitz was Secretary of the State, among the many things that were sort of unraveling for her was news about an email list that she was keeping that seemed to be the sort of thing where she shouldn't be mixing her office, Secretary of State, where you're gathering a lot of people's names, and her political office, where she's trying to get reelected, essentially keeping a database of people that she's sending out messages to. Now we see Denise Merrill is doing something that seems almost completely the same. I'll read a little bit of her statement that she made yesterday, Colin, in just a moment. But first of all, your reaction to this, is it the same as what we were talking about with Susan Bisewitz a couple years ago?
It's a little different. Bisewitz's database had things in it, had these kind of notations in it that really did seem as though they were the kinds of things you would want to know about somebody that you were going to be working on politically. I mean, they had, you know, references to religion and food allergies. I can't remember. They were like all this. This seems to have been kind of a straight newsletter, but it's close enough so that it shouldn't have happened. I mean, just as a calculation, as an understanding of what would or wouldn't fly, it shouldn't have happened.
The statement that she made yesterday says, first, I feel terrible that the way we send out these newsletters has created the impression for some that I'm using my office to somehow campaign for a future election. This was never the intent, and I'm deeply sorry if that impression has been created. I spent my entire career, as some have noted, being a champion for good government, but also also for open government, and I believe strongly that every office holder should be communicating with the public about what they are doing in office. That last piece is really interesting to me, this idea of every office holder being able to communicate with the public about what they're doing in office. This seems to be something she and a lot of other people do, Colin, but it does raise the question, I think, about when a re-election campaign stops and where doing your job starts. Jody Rell famously sat down with me years ago and said one of the big problems in Connecticut is all those distracting billboards along the side of the highway, except when she put her face on one of those billboards in order to deliver a message, which sounded an awful lot to some people like, vote for me again, I'm Jody Rell, I'm taking care of things. There is a very fuzzy line here. You collect data, and then you send out stuff to people to remind them what a good job I'm doing.
Yeah, I mean, they shouldn't put their faces on a billboard, and Denise Merrill, unfortunately, has done that as well. They shouldn't be making commercials in which they star, and which are about tourism in Connecticut or wearing your seatbelt or how to operate the new voting machines. I mean, they shouldn't be doing that. Those are effectively ways of boosting their visibility. I should say that I'm personally fond of Denise Merrill, you can't necessarily trust everything that I say about her because I do like her a lot as a person. But I will say this. I think this was really a huge mistake. As a political tool, it would be a bad political tool. Oddly enough, the things that would have taken the curse off of this as a scandal are exactly the things that would have made it a better political tool. In other words, if she did want to use this as a way to run for future office, the smart thing to do would be not to make it a bunch of Democrats who are all going to vote for her anyway. The smart thing to do would have been to open it up as much as possible and have a lot of unaffiliated voters. There's 800,000 affiliated voters in Connecticut, more than there are of any other kind of voters. So if you want to win elections, you've got to have those people. If you have 94% Democrats or whatever this thing was and 4% unaffiliated voters, it's oddly enough almost kind of a useless political tool. So you suffer all of the political and journalistic fallout of having done something that's stupid and unattractive without actually really having improved your political chances one iota.
Ron, do you see more of this happening? I mean, after the success of Howard Dean, followed by the remarkable success of Barack Obama in mining for data, collecting databases, reaching out to people in this new media society, do you see more of this sort of blurring of lines happening?
Well, you know, obviously we're all inundated by emails and other electronic communications to the extent that we kind of filter them out. Congress has a rule. They can use their frank only up to a period of time before the election, and then they can no longer get the free mailing privileges. That might be something of a break on some of this, but of course it wouldn't pertain to electronic communication. I should say, full disclosure, when I moved to stores 16 years ago, Denise Merrill was one of the first people I met. She's been a friend. I think that this, as Colin said, is atypical of a good public servant, and that's as much as I probably want to say.
Well, and it's another one of those conversations there. Well, I think it's important to say. Go ahead, Colin.
I would say one more thing. I think one of the problems here is that Denise Merrill spent most of her political career in the state legislature. If you want to learn about good government, good government practices that will avoid the appearance of conflict of interest or abuse of office, the Connecticut General Assembly is one of the worst places to train. They have essentially no code of ethics. It's like Sharia law there or something. It's just, you know, they just kind of make up whatever rules they want. And so in some ways, some of her blindness to how this was going to look maybe have been a product of her long service in a body that is so lacking in any kind of, you know, functional ethical rules that, you know, it's just a very poor place to get that education.
We're going to take some more of your phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266 as we consider the week's news here on WNPR on the Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is here. Ronald Schurin is here from UConn's Department of Political Science. I want to welcome back in Ariel Levin-Becker, who's health reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, because it's time for our Obamacare update. Hey, so we've now been a couple weeks into the rollout of the exchange here in Connecticut. We had some bumps along the road on the first few days, Ariel, but compared to what we've heard from the national federal database, my goodness, Connecticut seems like it's rolling right along. How do you see things going right now?
Certainly compared to what's going on nationally, where there's just a tremendous amount of technological problems, Connecticut is doing quite well. It's not a high bar, but generally when there's been national mention of Connecticut, it's usually as a state where things are going relatively well. There's still occasional glitches. I've heard about people having trouble finding lists of doctors who are participating with certain insurance plans. But in general, people have been able to browse the website and also to sign up for coverage. As of Friday, which is the last day they reported information, a little over 1,900 applications had been processed. And people can use the Access Health portal, their website, to apply for both Medicaid coverage that takes effect January 1st and for private insurance. So about half, a little over half of the people who are already signed up for coverage are going to be getting Medicaid, and the other slightly under half are people who signed up for private insurance. I believe those are people who selected a plan, they clicked the button that said, I want to purchase it. They have not written their checks yet, but that's sort of where things stand.
So given 1,900 people maybe in so far, is that about pacing on track with what they'd hope, maybe a little bit behind? We're talking about in the state 340,000 uninsured people. We understand we're not going to get them all signed up within the first couple months, but how are they doing as far as their what they hoped to have at this point?
That number, the sort of number of people who've actually signed up compared to the number of people who visited the website, it's gotten lots of scrutiny. There are a lot of critics who say, you know, you've gotten a huge amount of traffic. People have focused on that, but the number of people who've actually signed up is very small. The people running the exchange would tell you that it's actually been higher than they expected, the number of signups. They were expecting a lot of people might browse at first, but people weren't going to make their decisions now. The coverage doesn't take effect until January 1st at the earliest. So the expectation had been, and I think still is, that the majority of the traffic will come toward the end of November and into December.
Has cost been an issue at all and something that people are talking about? Obviously, we saw that report about Connecticut's overall health care costs being about the fourth highest in the nation. Then, not surprisingly, we come in at about fourth in the cost of the plans that we're offering through this Access Health CT. Has that been a barrier for people? Have you been talking to anyone who said, boy, I'd love to sign up for this, but it's just still too expensive?
Yeah, that's definitely been a big issue for people, particularly people who are uninsured right now and so aren't paying anything. Even if they qualify for a deeply discounted insurance rate, it could be a couple hundred dollars a month. That might be a good price for insurance sort of compared to what's often the price. But if you don't make a lot of money and aren't paying anything right now, it becomes a serious question. I think there are a lot of people who had thought that had an idea that it would be cheaper, and they're finding that, you know, they might be faced with a couple hundred dollars a month for a plan with a fairly significant deductible, and that's really giving a lot of people pause.
Ronna, I just have a quick national political question for you. It's really interesting. Of course, there's some states, a handful of states, that are running their own exchanges. Many other states are using this federal exchange. Some have opted out of the idea of expanding Medicaid altogether. That's a separate issue. I guess in the end, even though we're calling this colloquially Obamacare, does any of the success of what's happening in Connecticut really accrue to Barack Obama? At the end of the day, the federal system seems to so far be a bit of a joke. Their systems are crashing. Nobody's able to sign anything up, whereas Connecticut, Rhode Island, Kentucky seem to be doing just a bang-up job running their own exchanges for the most part.
This is in part a technical issue, and in part it's a broader issue. What I understand is that the complexity of this led several possible providers, not technical providers, not to compete. And so it was a procurement issue, and many people on the inside expected the kind of problems that developed nationally. Connecticut, obviously a smaller state, was able to deal with these. I have one question. One of the things that's been talked about in the budget deal is tighter verification of income for people applying. Will that have an impact in Connecticut? Is that likely to delay things? Is that likely to be a major problem?
That's a great question. Ariel?
I think it depends what the new standard would be for income verification. If it's real-time income verification, I think that would be very difficult because even the private sector struggles with that. My understanding is what Connecticut had been expected to do is when someone applies, the Connecticut system sort of pings this federal data hub, and they get information, or they're supposed to get information based on people's 2012 tax returns. That's the most recent thing on file with the federal government. And then people enter their projected 2014 income. If it's higher than what they earned in 2012 or sort of, I think, up to 10% lower, the system sort of takes their word because if they qualify for some sort of discount, it's based on their income. And if they're estimating higher income than is reported, that's not necessarily I think less of a concern. If someone reports a lower income by at least 10% or more, then the Connecticut exchange, their plan had been to give people 90 days to submit some sort of verification of why that would be. And of course, this would all be reconciled when they file their taxes for 2014.
Yeah. Of course, the thing I was looking over at Colin, maybe he and I are thinking the same thing. You ping the federal data hub and there's just nobody there to be pinged.
Well, there's that too. But I mean, just listen to what Ariel just said. I mean, it's one of the things that makes me think this is something of a straw man issue. I mean, there really is income verification right now, probably about as good a system as you could expect. It was part of the law originally. I mean, I think, once again, they're sort of larding these counter proposals with things that kind of look good and maybe they can say something to their constituents back home, like we got better income verification. I don't see that as a really substantive question.
Yeah, I don't think it is either, but I think it is maybe the one thing that the Obama administration could say, well, we're not making any changes in Obamacare. We're just verifying something already in the law, and the Republicans can say we got something. So that may be about all.
It seems that due to very heavy lobbying efforts, the one thing that might change about Obamacare is that medical devices tax. That seems to be the thing that everyone seems to agree on. For some reason, I haven't really seen exactly what the impact of the medical devices tax is going to be, but the industry itself says that it will lose tens of thousands of dollars, and I'm sure the industry is exactly right. We'll leave it at that. Ariel Levin Becker, a health reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, thanks as always for the update.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about some other stories of this week. Colin McEnroe has been following one having to do with a tennis tournament that's, well, not had a whole lot of success in recent years, and now the state of Connecticut might just be buying, and Jeff Cohen is also reporting on some fiscal dirty dealings in Hartford. That's a huge surprise. You can join the conversation here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, you know Frank Tavares is the voice of NPR. It's hard to imagine what NPR will sound like without him, but he is going to be leaving the network soon. We'll be talking to him. He's a Connecticut resident and a big supporter of WNPR, about his career at NPR, but also about his brand new book of short stories. Yeah, he's a fiction writer as well and a professor at SCSU. Frank Tavares stops by our studios tomorrow here on Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Ronald Sheeran from the University of Connecticut joins us in studio today, as well as, of course, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Joining us by phone for a few minutes is Jeff Cohen, WNPR's reporter, who's been following, as always, an ongoing saga in Hartford. Jeff, it always seems like there's something happening with money in Hartford. What's happening now?
Good question. Good morning, John. What's happening now is sort of a tough story to explain quickly. The gist of it is that a report surfaced that was written inside the Board of Education that essentially, and the Board of Education becomes not a big part of the story after I say the report came from the Board of Education, that says that the city treasurer suggests that city treasurer Adam Cloud somehow steered business, a city insurance business, to an insurance broker who then also rented office space from Adam Cloud's family and hired Adam Cloud's brother to be its state lobbyist. This is all interesting. Why is this interesting? Because that insurance company, the company's name is Hybrid Insurance Group, that insurance company has failed to pay over about $670,000 in insurance premiums for the city of Hartford. Good thing is that the city has not lost its coverage. I think there's a state law that prevents that. But there's a question of where did this $670,000 go, and it's still unanswered.
It's still unanswered, and as you report yesterday, the man who runs this company, who's essentially in charge of paying off this premium, has had some of his own financial problems, and these financial problems are all happening concurrent with this missing money.
That's right. And I should back up, John, and say that the city treasurer, Adam Cloud, denies wholeheartedly that he had anything to do with steering business to this company, Hybrid Insurance Group. And in fact, he says, there's no way I could have. I don't have a seat at that table, right? The city treasurer doesn't authorize those kinds of contracts. That said, Hybrid Insurance Group itself, the man who runs it is a young man by the name of Earl O'Garrow from, he went to Wesleyan and owns property in Bloomfield and in Marlboro. I went out to Marlboro yesterday just to look through the land records and to check out some information there. As I was there, there was an attorney there who happened to be filing foreclosure papers on Mr. O'Garrow's home. So at the same time, roughly, over the summer, at the same time that he was not paying $670,000 in insurance premiums for the city, he was borrowing more than $800,000 on his home that he had just bought, really within the same month as when it started back in July.
So, I just want to get a quick reaction as we run a little low on time here from Colin McEnroe. This is, I mean, as I say, it's another one of these series of things in Hartford that we seem to hear all the time. Is there any big surprise in here? Is there news in here for you, Colin?
Well, I mean, the concern that I have is increasingly Hartford, the city of Hartford, has become one of those hapless protagonists like David Copperfield or Charlie Brown, to whom things happen all the time and who don't really appear to be able to do very much about it. And I think if you have a climate where somebody can have a contract to maintain your golf courses and maintain your parks and not do that job and not suffer any immediate penalties, you start to attract other kinds of people who will take, you know, slightly in south of $700,000 of your money and not do anything with it. And not actually pay the insurance on it. And so, I mean, ultimately, I sort of would like to see the Segarra administration find its inner Buddy Cianci and do something about this.
Jeff Cohen from WNPR will be continuing to follow the story. Thanks so much for updating us, Jeff. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tom.
Now, Colin, we want to end with this, and you've been writing about the city of New Haven and the state of Connecticut. There's this tennis tournament that we knew for a long time as the Pilot Penn Tennis Tournament. It's fallen a bit on hard times. Are we going to end up owning this tennis tournament,
it
Colin?
It seems almost certain that we will. It'll be done through the CRDA, which is a quasi-public entity, which is therefore not even amenable to guidance from, say, elected representatives in the General Assembly, not that they necessarily would. And, you know, this tennis tournament, we are buying a dying patient on the table, at least from the looks of things. It's a tennis tournament whose attendance has been seriously flagging. We've put $18 million into the tennis complex itself. It's one of the biggest tennis venues in the world. Seats 15,000 people. The final this past year was attended by slightly less than 4,000 people. So, yeah, I mean, it's first of all, you know, I don't know what Ron thinks about this, but in terms of any understood function of government, the most expansive vision of the function of government, owning a professional tennis tournament seems like kind of a stretch, even given the argument that it's a driver of economic activity.
But it's this is driver of economic activity piece of it, and we've heard a lot of this from the Malloy administration. Look, he wants to put money into businesses that may or may not move in the future because he wants to retain jobs here. He wants to maybe put money into a tennis tournament because it may or may not be an economic driver. There is an argument by some to be made that if the state doesn't step in and do this, then we do lose the possibility of making this revenue, Ron.
That's the argument that's been made, and sometimes it is right and sometimes it's wrong. When FDR became president in 1932, he said, well, we're going to try a lot of things. Some of them will work, some of them won't. And the country went along with that. I can't speak to the tennis issue. I don't know enough about it. But you look at New York City, for example, that took over its radio station under Mayor LaGuardia. One could probably have said at that time that that's not something that the city government should be doing, but many people cherished that. So, you know, you pick your sites for public investment, and sometimes they work out, sometimes they don't.
It's one of those things, though, Colin, if it leaves a – I think some people might say, well, that's one more thing like the Whalers that Connecticut just doesn't have that we used to have that could generate some ancillary income.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the questions is, if it's so great, why doesn't anybody want to spend any private money on it? And yeah, this is not a lot of money. I mean, it's a little bit more than $600,000 to buy it, and then there'll be at least $400,000 to maintain it. We know that number will go up. It's just the way of things. That's too low a number. You know, I mean, obviously, as Everett Dirksen said, a million here, a million there. After a while, you're talking about some real money. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, still a fair question is, okay, if this is so great, if we need it so bad, why doesn't it work? Why aren't there private entities willing to? I mean, there are. It does have sponsors. The sponsors apparently don't sponsor it enough. If it's so terrific, why doesn't it work on its own merits?
I guess I'm wondering, just this last little bit of time, if the state of Connecticut buys this tournament and we own it, it won't be called the Pilot Penn, probably. What do you think we should call it, Colin?
Well, I think Dan Malloy and Chris Christie should play a match there, and I bet you I could get more than 4,000 people to come watch that.
Bruce Barber is actually the stadium announcer there. Bruce Barber calling a tennis match between Dan Malloy and Chris Christie with you as the color commentator. I would pay good money to see that. Colin McEnroe, the host of WNPR's The Colin McEnroe Show, he's going to be talking about the Scottish play this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Thanks, Colin.
Thanks.
Thanks also to Ron Sheeran, who's an associate professor in residence at UConn's Department of Political Science. Great to see you, Ron. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives. Feel better, Tucker. With Betsy Kaplan and Heather Brandon, the senior producer is Katie Solarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.